The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. And as the UK heads towards the longest, darkest day of the year, we hope to lighten your spirits with some optimism and good news from the technology world. Joining me in the studio is Jemima Kish, The Guardian's digital media correspondent. Jemima, what have you been playing with that has kept you chipper as the nights draw in?
Well, no technology, just my son. I know that sounds really twee and mumsy, but it's true. I've taught him now to do an elephant impression and a monkey impression and a gorilla impression, which involves beating his chest. But with the aid, actually, of the iPad app, which is called something like Animals HD. So there's a picture of the animal on screen and you press it and it goes... or whatever the appropriate... That was an elephant. Whatever the appropriate noise is.
The visual to really get that.
He does the little arm action with the... what's it called? Trunk thing. Waving.
Pictures or
sweet.
It didn't happen.
Do
send them over.
Regular David Attenborough. Yeah.
We'll put them up on the Flickr group and we will have the special audio version of Artley's fun with the iPhone iPad app. Well, this week, we're finding out how the Creative Commons movement offers a bright outlook for the future and how your daily commute can be a fun experience rather than a slog. We'll also be looking at the latest news headlines to rock the technology world. So keep listening to the next 30 minutes with The Guardian. Few new technologies have had as much of an impact on the regulation landscape as the printing press. Now, I promise this is relevant. Invented in around 1450, Gutenberg's revolutionary invention ushered in the concept of intellectual property, rightful ownership of creative works, and set the wheels in motion for the first copyright laws and statutes. That system has transformed very little over the centuries, partially because replicating works on a commercial scale, whether it's music or video or even the written word, requires quite a lot of money. But now, with the web and other digital technologies, content that's digitized can be instantly replicated and distributed on a massive scale, virtually for free. And as the music industry is aware, it is. Yet, the regulators have changed very little when it comes to the idea of rights. We still live in an all-rights-reserved world dominated by trademarks and copyrights. Creative Commons is a not-for-profit organization that seeks to transform the legal regulations of ownership in the age of the internet. Joy Ito is its CEO. He came into The Guardian recently and began by explaining to me what exactly Creative Commons means in practice.
Creative Commons itself is a nonprofit organization with volunteer judges, lawyers, activists in 80-100 countries. And we create software, technical tools, and legal tools that allow people who create content to mark their works with the permissions and sometimes with restrictions that they would like other people to adhere to. And it's an important thing because it makes it so you don't have to ask each time how you can use this work. And more importantly, it allows technology, search engines, and software tools to know the intent of the author when it's working with things. So it lowers the friction of sharing and of collaboration and of moving things around. We're now at the point where there's an abundance of information that can connect, but the main friction right now is a legal friction. And just like we got network guys and we got the software guys to move on to do more interesting things, and we're trying to remove lawyers and get them to move on to do more interesting things than clearing rights. So the result, I hope, is that we will have an explosion of innovation on top of that in this sort of content sharing space, and it will be used in ways that we can't even anticipate.
Peter Sunde, from the Pirate Bay and Flatter, recently said to me that he thought of, and believe me, this is going somewhere, he thought of eating meat as a cult. And when he stopped eating meat, he's a vegan, he discovered that it was a cult. It was just something that, you bought into and you didn't question. And he then proposed that copyright is a cult. This concept of ownership, of content, of a work. And so how do you conceive of ownership and what we need to understand about ownership, how it needs to transform in this digital age now that the technological restrictions are being reduced to a phenomenal extent?
Creative Commons is pro-copyright, and we work within the constraints of copyright trying to create a solution. It's kind of a hack, right? It's a way to, within copyright, lower the friction to the extent possible without breaking the law and without trying to cause people who use copyright in a variety of ways to change what they do. And Creative Commons has a very specific position, which is fundamentally, and we believe in open is better because we think that there is sort of a misconception that everything needs to be locked up. But generally speaking, we aren't normative. We don't go around telling people they should give things away. And what we like is we just want to allow people to express the choices that they have made. Okay. With my other hat on, which is a much more sort of free thinking, where do I think things are going person, I do think that the models that we've created around ownership and around copyright are sort of outdated and are causing friction on innovation.
What would you say is the shift in the concept of the value of the product then between, say, copyright, which is a model in which you pay money and you say, here you go, this innovation, this idea, this concept, this written work, this audio, you know, this music track is worth a dollar or a pound, mm-hmm. versus a Creative Commons model wherein you say, I'm going to attribute, or if I pay a dollar, it's not because you're making me, it's because I think that your work is good. What do you think is the conceptual shift in value?
I think the basic idea that information is the same as a thing, where if you give it away, you don't have it anymore. That, I mean, if a banana is worth a dollar, you give it away, you don't have it anymore. That's a very simplistic view of how the information economy works. It's never worked that way, even before Creative Commons, even before Hollywood, because if you are an academic and your value increases every time somebody references your paper, and if you charged a dollar for every person to cite your paper, that would increase the friction of people citing your paper. And as an academic, would you rather get cited by somebody in their paper, or would you rather get a dollar? And so what you're doing when you think about Creative Commons is you're trying to make a decision, and it's not for everybody. You're trying to make a decision about, is it more valuable for me to get cited, to get seen, or is it more valuable for me to create a barrier to that access and get paid? And if you're Madonna, and everybody knows who you are, and everybody wants your stuff, and citation doesn't help you at all anymore, then of course you probably want to have strict copyright and sort of dole it out. If no one's ever heard of you, and some people are happy to cite you, but they don't really want to pay you, and those people who want to cite you, you know, are going to tell other people and tell other people, then it probably makes sense. Now, Creative Commons, we have 6 different licenses with a variety of different restrictions. So there's definitely a way to preserve certain parts of the business model. And I think that, again, the fundamental idea is that, you know, we're not against making money, and it's not about giving it away to charity. You know, in some cases it is, but if you're a professional, what you're going to be thinking about is, do I benefit more by opening access or not?
As a VC of note, you have invested in some great startups and you've supported some great startups. Can you explain to me what you see are some of the trends that are forthcoming in web? Is it things that facilitate the distribution of knowledge? You know, what would you say are some of the high-level trends? And what are the trends in the different areas around the world, given that you now live in Dubai?
The really scrappy designers are kind of in New York. And I think the sort of growth of New York VC is kind of interesting, because if you look at and compare the design of products and websites in California with the products and websites from New York and even London, it's a little bit scrappier, a little bit cooler. I don't think Silicon Valley really gets cool. I mean, I think that Steve Jobs is, you know, in the world of the blind, you know, I mean, he's one of the few design-oriented people in Silicon Valley, and that's why he's able to kind of push things forward really well, because he's able to put that together. I think that as we start moving up the stack, and we're now getting to how do we bring museums online, how do we fund music, how do we come up with art projects, those kinds of ideas are really difficult to find people who have that sensibility in Silicon Valley, where you have, you know, really brilliant programmers with Asperger's all grouped together doing their thing. And that's a great thing. So I do think that you have a lot of momentum in Silicon Valley, but I do think that it's shifting to Europe and to New York for a lot of this innovation. So again, I think that this layer of culture, politics, content, and education, science, that's a hard one. The other big difference is that now the software development has gotten easier and easier and easier, so that if you sat down now with a couple of Ruby on Rails developers and designers and you sort of pulled up a screen, actually a scientist or an artist could sit down and kind of have a conversation and knock out a website in a weekend. And the ability to work together like that wasn't around before. So I think that the next real explosion is going to be these people who to whom the internet was a black box. Internet is going to become no longer a black box, and then you'll find innovation. The Middle East, it's very underdeveloped in many ways. There's very little content. It's kind of cliche, but mobile is high penetration in Asia and the Middle East and Africa. But you have 200 million Arab speakers. There are a lot of issues. The money's not necessarily well distributed, but there's a lot there. The average age is very young. Also, it's interesting because with 9/11 and all this sort of anti-Muslim stuff going on in the rest of the world, a lot of talent's moving back to the Middle East. So if you go to Beirut, you'll find a whole bunch of American and European educated Arabs hanging out creating companies. And it takes a while for an ecosystem to kick in. It takes a while for the laws to change so that it's easier to set up companies, so that you have bankruptcy laws and things like that. So it's unclear exactly when it's going to go, but I do think that the Middle East is going to go. And the trick for venture capitalists is you got to be there before it happens. Because if you chase peaks, you always get there when it's about to end. And that's why I'm very interested in the Middle East long term.
Joy Ito. You can read more of that interview in Sunday's Observer New Review. That's last Sunday. And you can hear more about how Creative Commons philosophy affects science in the academic world in this week's Science Weekly podcast, which is at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Here's Jemima with this week's news headlines.
As we record this program, a cyber war over WikiLeaks appears to be escalating. Supporters of the site are reportedly targeting DNS attacks on the Swiss bank that froze the assets of founder Julian Assange and PayPal, who closed WikiLeaks' account. Last week, Amazon.com stopped serving WikiLeaks only 24 hours after being contacted by the staff of Joe Lieberman, chairman of the American Senate's Committee on Homeland Security. Hosting provider EveryDNS followed suit within days, saying the DNS attacks on WikiLeaks itself was threatening access to 500,000 other websites. Google's been busy this week, announcing the launch of its ebook service in the US and a new Google phone, the Nexus S. Google eBooks is slated to arrive in other countries next year, and they join the other two big players in the ebook market, Amazon and Apple. Books are available on laptops or notebooks, will incorporate rights management, and will be stored in an online library, so even if your device is lost, you still have access to your books. The Nexus S sees the search giant return to brand its own mobile phones, though the model is built for them by Samsung and will be sold through Carphone Warehouse and Best Buy stores. The phone will also be the first to feature Gingerbread, release 2.3 of Google's Android phone operating system, and will allow users to search and create messages from voice commands. Finally, the Culture Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, has announced a further £50 million of funding for new projects to push forward the government's ambitions to get superfast broadband to every community in the UK. The intention is to get a digital hub connected by fibre optics in every area by 2015, allowing connections with a maximum speed of 40 megabits per second. But critics say the new plans do not address fundamental problems with the way that BT controls the infrastructure needed to install new fibre systems, nor ease inequalities in the way that BT is charged for fibre compared to smaller companies.
Thanks, Jemima. You can keep up on all this week's stories and headlines at guardian.co.uk/technology. Chromaroma is a citywide game that makes travelling around London more engaging and playful. Built by Toby Barnes and his Midlands-based company Mudlark and funded by 4IP and Screen West Midlands, it works by tracking where you go using your Oyster card, a travel pass that uses an RFID chip, and sets goals and challenges you to discover new parts of the city and new public transportation options. It also highlights communities of people just like you who move around in previously unarticulated masses. Rich pickings for new friends and new ideas, and for making the commute a little more thrilling. Now, Jemima, you spoke with Toby about the project.
Well, it seems that everyone and everything is being gamified these days, and Mudlark are the team behind the Playful Conference. So they, to no small extent, are responsible for people gamifying things, because they've had a conference encouraging people to do just that. But even Toby admits that that's gone a little bit too far. But this is exactly what they're doing with Chromaroma. They're trying to gamify the commute, but they're giving a kind of lesson in how gamification should be done. He popped into the studio earlier today, and I started by asking him, what was your inspiration for Chromaroma?
Just about a year ago now, just over a year ago, we started looking, like a lot of people, at RFID and looking at what we can do to make games with RFID, as we've all got kind of some chip somewhere on us. And we also started looking at how we can play with data shadows and play with and bring to attention what shadows people are making. So we did what everyone else did, and we burnt the acid, the Oyster card, in acid, and we took it apart, and we found out how much memory there was on there, and we're all excited by that. But we soon realized that that was probably the wrong way of going, and quite illegal, and people weren't very happy with what we were doing with it. So we started looking at the infrastructure that's already in place, and realized that with the Oyster card, that there's tons of data, and literally tons and tons of data that we're generating and is storing.
So it's got the chartiness of Last.fm and perhaps the healthiness of doing something physical. What does it actually look like to the user? How do they interact with it?
If you go to the website, you see two things. One is you get to access your data, and that's in charts and visual diagrams and things. But also, that's one thing that's what's really important to us, is we didn't want to do a Google Street Map or an OpenStreetMap kind of dot thing. We're huge Harry Beck fans. I mean, you know, we're the biggest Harry Beck fan, the guy who originally did the tube map. And so we wanted to do something that at least felt that we could stand somewhere near him and not just do a street map. So we've created, we think, the world's first 3D space flash live data mashup thing. And it looks like Tron. Well, the first version looked like Tron. So, because there's a lot of men in the team, it was black. And your journeys along the tube were shooting blue lines. And there was a kind of very macho feel to it, which we've now kind of moved on from.
And perhaps makes it feel slightly more dynamic than it is when you experience it in person.
Well, I think that's very much the point of it. Commuting can be a chore, and we wanted to make the commute something that you took you beyond what it actually was. So that what games can you play in your head? So as you swipe your card in, are you going on a mission into town? Are you Jason Bourne? Are you going in? Are you going into work to take someone out? By creating a framework that allows people to be a bit more dynamic, enables people to have a little bit of magic all the way through their daily life.
So you're introducing an element of psychogeography. I think that's
absolutely
something we're interested in, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I think that people help enjoy playing is that finding new routes through a city, or looking up, just simply looking up and finding what amazing things happen in the city. And when you're able to slightly, very, very slightly go outside the realms of your I'm going from A to B, it's amazing what you discover.
And get off one stop early. That's something else you've encourage people to do.
We can recommend which is generally your home station, or generally your recommended destination. And if we can recommend that to you, then we can also know what the adjacent stations are. So if you get off a stop earlier, you can get double points. And it's amazing how many people kind of go and do it. It was an experiment again. A lot of the game is about experimenting, what happens, what doesn't happen. But what's the incentive? How big does that incentive need to be to actually get you off one stop earlier?
So you obviously have to work quite closely with TfL.
Yeah.
How's that?
Fun. I mean, I'm amazed, absolutely amazed, how far TfL have come in the last year. And the more I learn about working with TfL, is the more I'm amazed they keep the system running as they do. It's like balancing 15 metal balls on a glass plate and keeping them all balanced at the same time. But they've come a long way. They have started delivering APIs. They have started delivering station data information. They have started changing the way in which they look at things. And they're an organisation that's based in Victorian times. You know, their feet are fairly fixed in steam travel. That this is a whole new era for them, and they're really trying to get their heads around what it means to them to be a data company, and why do people actually want to see data. It was fascinating when we were talking to them about the difference between pay-as-you-go cards and travel cards. And originally they were talking very much, well, if you have a travel card, you're not interested in your data. It's like a mobile phone. If you have free calls, you don't care how long that call was. And we talked to them about them, and we kind of explained that actually people are interested in the data, and they're interested in ways of backing that data up and finding out the patterns of their data, what happens when they see the big picture. So that they are, it is a challenge. I mean, it's not an easy thing. They're not just opening doors and letting us do what we want. But it's an experience as well, and I think that's important. It's a learning experience.
Given that 4IP is RIP now, how are you going to make money? How are you going to support this game?
The game launched on the 30th of November, and we have, at the moment, we're concentrating very much on building the numbers up, making sure it's fun, making sure it's something that people want to do. And also what's interesting is that it does a lot of stuff with passive play. So it's not like Foursquare where you have to check into places and check out of places. Because it uses your Oyster card and it's something you're doing automatically, there's a lot of play that people can dip in and dip out. And there's a friend of mine called Tom Armitage who suggested a really interesting idea as part of the game design very early on about developing seasons, having ends. A lot of problems with games we find now is that they're just ongoing. You can't see an end. So after a while, people just get bored. Well, what's the point? I'm never going to get anywhere. So we've delivered seasons. So more like an American TV show, you have three monthly seasons. And we have awards that we give to the winners of each of those seasons, maybe the most travelled.
So you could have sponsors for seasons.
Absolutely. So we are talking to a number of physical locations that are interested in putting in. But we're also interested in the idea of fear in games. So one of the things we have is a thing called a leech that sucks your points. And so as a player, you can place a leech somewhere. So I know that you might come into Victoria. I'm going to place a leech at Victoria. So you're going to be there and I'm going to suck all your points from not even going into London. So you're worried about that. So you purchase armour. If you have armour, then no one can get your points. Or a mirror that reflects it back on me. And there's all sorts of things we can play with about, more like a board game than necessarily a video game.
But is there any social good in this? Or is it a game for game's sake? Because there's a lot of talk about the gamification of fairly mundane things to try and make them a little bit more interesting. But are we a little bit saturated with that now? Does there need to be a purpose to it?
I think it's funny because another thing that we do is we organise the Playful Conference in October. A couple of years ago, we had all the speakers were talking about the value of games and how important games have been to them and how it's going to be important in their work. This year, I stood up at the front and said, I'm sorry, we all messed it up. Everyone's taken what we said and run with it. And it's like they've seen a disco somewhere on a film and they've got a record and they've put a beat over it and said, there you go, it's dance music. And it looks like dance music and it sounds like dance music and some people like it. But it's not dance music, it's just two things put together. And I think the current place we're in at the moment is we shouldn't have these running jokes. This should be a place where we discover what this means, what gamification means. And I still think gamification is really, really important, but it's not just points and badges. A lot of people have written things and talked about actually you need game designers. And I totally agree that if you're going to make a game, have a game designer. You can't just have a UX person trying to remove friction. It needs to be about something that's playful.
And so in 2 years' time, if we're all much healthier because we're all getting off several stops early and jogging, where are you going to be with Chromaroma? Is it going to be a big fat Barclaycard sponsored extravaganza, or is it just one project and you'll have moved on to something more exciting then?
We're very interested to see how Chromaroma grows. One of the things for us from a commercial point of view is that we are talking to other cities around the world, and places like Sao Paulo is an interesting one because Sao Paulo doesn't have any outside advertising, so it has no hoardings. The mayor a few years ago said that my city looks really, really ugly because advertising's everywhere. Right, that's it, all gone today, and it went. So a lot of advertisers we're talking to are interested about how you can send messages to people in another way. How can you tell stories in another way? But from a game point of view, I'm interested to see if you can create a game that's Tokyo versus London or Paris versus Moscow, or what does that kind of thing mean? And one of the things we're doing is we're interesting new game layers to the game, so enable people to completely skin the game in a different way. So although you'll be travelling around the same places, you may think it's Victorian gas lamp England and your Holmes is your Moriarty or something, all these kind of things. Or maybe I'm playing a kind of Warren Ellis 2050 London underwater with a jetpack around different places. So there's lots of different ways of playing the same city. And if you can have cities versus cities and so on and so forth, it becomes interesting.
Toby Barnes, developer of Chromaroma. And Jemima, gamifying or gamification or whatever you want to call it is a trend. Why?
Well, people are looking for ways of injecting fun into things, whether that's, I don't know, even reading a newspaper or going around the supermarket, whatever it is. you can inject some fun and some personality, and you can play on people's social networks, and you can give people much more of an incentive to do things. And I also think quite a lot of marketeers have sort of been quite quick to jump onto the gamification trend, because it, of course, it means that they can follow people's actions and behaviour, and with locations as well. There's a lot of sweet spots there for commercialising things, which, if you're a small group of developers, isn't a bad bad way to build a business.
I do actually find it quite worrying. Frankly, I'm a psychologist. I'm aware that basically what this is cognitive behavioral therapy. And by giving people incentives, by, you know, giving them rewards for doing stuff, whether it is, you know, taking less public transport or, you know, adopting this thing, you're effectively trying to change people's behavior, aren't you? Isn't that a worrying thing?
Well, they, as in Mudlark, have produced a game before called Heartlands, which is a sort of heart rate monitor game. But that kind of thing actually has a positive outcome. So there's a social benefit there. There's people's health. That's good, isn't it? I turn it around.
No, absolutely. But I think that, as you said, that it can be used very much for commercial purposes because there are so many sweet spots. And it'll be interesting to see what happens to the game development community and to, you know, to the design community and indeed to the advertising community, as many game developers and other creative people then move into advertising. Because that's what's happening. People want that kind of game experience to get people to buy things or to do things.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but the psychology of it is that people are rewarded with a lot of digital tools and services. They get a sort of they get that neurological reflex in the brain where they're rewarded for new behaviour or exciting behaviour. But that actually is a problem that we do need to fix. People need to be rewarded for staying and focusing on something, for concentrating on something. And perhaps there's a role for gaming there in encouraging people to do, you know, read more long-form content or listen to more long-form audio, like the Tech Weekly podcast. But just think about things and approach things and study them in more depth rather than flicking over to the next big, shiny, techie object.
There are some really impressive and exciting and intensive positive things that can come out of this incentivization. But what do you think is going to happen as more advertising, as more marketing does start to slap the gamification beats onto their existing things? How is that going to affect how people do think about playing with the content, playing with new stuff?
It's very enticing. It's very alluring. I think people sort of pile into it. And if there's, especially if there's a tangible material benefit to be gained by playing it, there's only going to be more and more of this kind of stuff. What I think is more interesting is to look at the nuance of some of the ideas that Chromeroma and the Mudlark team are coming up with. So talking about storytelling in this kind of way, and they're very interested in ideas of psychogeography. So that's exploring the imaginative space around a geographical framework. So if you get off a stop early and you take an entirely different route, what do you discover? What is there that triggers your imagination? Who do you bump into? What's the history of the place there? There are so many ideas for developing this in a very meaningful, rewarding, imaginative way that's not just about, you know, getting 10 extra points.
Absolutely. I think my biggest concern is that these are such powerful techniques to, as you say, create these imaginative experiences. I just don't want it to turn into 5 years from now somebody saying, you know, let's do a gamified campaign, like they say, you know, get me a viral, let's do a viral now.
Well, you know, that's where it's our role to find the projects that are really valuable and really imaginative and doing really, really interesting work that makes people think and does something really important, rather than just, you know, get a cheap McDonald's.
Well, Chromeroma launched in the capital last week, and you can find out more at guardian.co.uk/media/PDA and chromeroma.com. All the links are on the Tech Weekly site. Well, that's it for this week. I hope we've managed to make your day a little less gloomy. Many thanks to our guests, Joy Ito and Toby Barnes. Thanks to Jemima for her natural sunshine.
Oh, God bless.
And to our producer, Scott Colley, for the vitamin D pills. Next week, Charles Arthur speaks with Doc Searles, and I grill the executive director of the Wikimedia Foundation about Jimmy Wales' personal appeal. Thanks for listening. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.